Today is 12 May 2006. We're at the Hampton Inn in Fernandina Beach. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing William Merrick Birdsong. He was born on 27 March 1941 in Jacksonville, Florida. He currently resides at 407 Portside Drive, Fernandina Beach. My name is Edgar Johnson, and I will interview Bill on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is David Harmon, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Bill, I notice that you joined the Air Force back in 1962. Could you tell us a little bit about your decision to join the military?
Well, it really came from somewhat of indecision. I had started college in 1959 and did very, very poorly, and then later became interested in perhaps going into medicine. I had worked as an orderly, they don't have those anymore, at a hospital in Tallahassee, but my grade point average because of that first semester would never be adequate. So I was actually fearful of graduating, so I dropped out of college my senior year, with the family saying, of course, I'd never return. What I didn't realize that all the men my age of 18 had registered for the draft, and I immediately became 1A, and I was going to be drafted into the Army, and I knew that would be for 2 years with no training. So I talked to the Air Force recruiter and thought maybe I could become a medic and would have 4 years to think about medicine and see it. And I took the exam in Jacksonville, and the recruiter said I scored very high and would have no problem qualifying to be a medic. Well, I was in the Air Force for 4 years as an enlisted man, and the only time I saw a hospital was on my discharge physical in 1966.
I noticed you became a Korean linguist. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, at that time, anyone that scored a certain score in the general category was given a language test. Dr. Thorpe from Yale University came down and gave us intensive circle creation for 3 days. If we scored high enough on that test, we had 2 days of intensive Chinese, a tonal language. And during the tonal interview, I couldn't do it. I can't sing, I couldn't do the tones, but I did well on the written test. So the next day, they brought us all into a room and went one name at a time, saying the language school we'd been selected for, and I was selected for Korean. And immediately I said yes, because the other options were air police or cook. I had no idea where Korea was. Basic training for me lasted 3 months because they put us all together awaiting the beginning of the school. And then we were all sent to Yale University to the Institute of Far Eastern Language. And for 11 months, we studied Korean 6 to 8 hours a day.
Did you have to wear a uniform while you were at Yale?
Yes, we have never confused ourselves with being Yalees. We wore a uniform, but we did eat in the dining hall with the Yale students, but they really didn't have too much to do with us.
What was it? That was just the beginning of the Vietnam era. What was it like to wear a uniform on campus at that time?
Well, actually, Vietnam didn't start really until 1964, and I was in Korea by then. So we were still kind of with positive attitudes toward the military. Although there were some people, like some of the young women in the area, that would not date anyone in uniform, of course.
Now, you sort of skipped over basic training. Were there any episodes that are memorable or friendships from that era?
Well, the most interesting thing about basic training for a Southern person was they threw us together in mixed units. And most of us growing up in Jacksonville in the 50s probably had never met an African-American before our age. And on the way to Lackland Air Force Base, the plane was delayed because of weather, so we took a bus. And on the trip through the South, we stopped to eat, and the restaurant owner would not allow the black troops to get off the bus. And we all looked at each other and wondered what this was going to be like. And we got off and ate and took food back to the black troops, and I've regretted that the rest of my life, that we all didn't refuse to go into the restaurant. The races got along very well, though, during basic training, of course, because we had a common enemy, the Air Force. I was 21 at the time, a little older than most of the other guys, so basic training was really very easy. We did have some people break down mentally and have to leave basic, and I have no idea what happened to them. I assume they were discharged from the military.
Did you make any lasting friendships during that era of the Air Force?
The second phase of basic, because the school wasn't starting, threw together all the people who were going to become linguists. So I was with these guys for 3 years. And some of them remain friends today that I occasionally visit, and some I email at least once a week.
Okay. Now, I noticed you left the Air Force in 1966. Was that because your tour was up, or you had decided not to make the Air Force a career? What led to that decision?
Well, the Air Force for the first 3 years was fantastic. Yale University was very interesting. The radio training to be a voice intercept operator was interesting. The time in Korea changed my life, of course. I became very interested in Asia. In fact, if you read Mitchner's book, he talks of people going Asiatic. And many of us in my group that spoke the language did. We became obsessed with Korea. If there had been an advanced Korean course like there was Japanese, I probably would have stayed in the military at that time. But they brought us all back as clerk typists. So for my last year, I sat in an orderly room typing orders. And the lieutenant asked me toward the end of my 4-year tour, was I going to stay in, and I just laughed.
What did you do when you got out of the Air Force?
Well, I got out of the service, and 10 days later, I was in Hawaii. I didn't know anyone in Hawaii, but had read Mitchner's book, and I knew that was where some of the best language and anthropology training was. So I immediately left for the University of Hawaii and enrolled in the Department of Anthropology and taking more Korean. And then within a year, I graduated because of my prior college. But I stayed around for a master's degree and took 2 years of Japanese and met my future wife.
Okay. What led you to go back into the Air Force?
Well, the field of anthropology was very difficult at that time. The government had put a lot of money into the field. I had a 2-year fellowship at the East-West Center, and the Department of Anthropology went from 12 to 45 in about a 2-year period. So I could see this was going to be a difficult field to be very successful in. And I always had that hankering for medicine. It stayed with me through the 4 years. In fact, I used to sit watching the scope, monitoring the North Korean Air Force, and plan how I was going to become a physician. But then the obsession with Korea led me to anthropology instead. So that was where I wanted to go.
So tell me a little bit about coming back into the Air Force. What was that like?
Well, at the University of Hawaii Medical School, I finally got into medical school after 6 years of BA and MA in anthropology, and it was $85 a semester. My father became ill, and I'd been away for almost 10 years, so I went back to Florida to see how they were doing, and did not think that he would live until I finished school. So I contacted Emory University in Atlanta and was able to get into a school there after 1 year of med school at the University of Hawaii. And it went from $85 a semester to over $3,000. So at that time, they started the Health Professions Scholarship Program. And I took that starting my second year of med school and stayed in it for 3 years.
Was it any different in being a medical student being in the Air Force? Out of the Air Force?
We had occasional meetings, but we didn't wear a uniform, and the time didn't count for time in grade or time in service, although we would use it for time and pay later. But during the summers, we were on active duty, which gave us a better salary. And one summer I spent researching gonorrhea at the Emory University under Air Force sponsorship. And then the next summer, I was at Wolford Hall, the main teaching hospital for the Air Force in San Antonio, in an OBGYN clerkship.
Was it any difference being a linguist or being a doctor in the Air Force?
Well, it's completely different, of course. Is the enlisted time, I was a linguist, I was enlisted, and we were treated a little differently than as a physician.
Tell me a little bit about the difference in treatment.
Well, in Korea, I was there for 14 months. We lived in open bay barracks. We worked shift work, monitoring the North Korean Air Force. So it was very interesting, but it was not the status of being a physician or an officer, of course.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, your obsession with Asia and Korea, did that change at all as a result of going to medical school? Did you continue that?
Well, it continued to a degree, but not to the level that it had been before. I think in James Mitchell's terms, I had gone Asiatic while in Korea, and my wife is a Korean-American, and I continued an interest in that for a number of years. My master's degree in anthropology was done at the East-West Center, and I went back to Korea for research there.
Okay. Did you meet your wife in Korea?
No, I met her in third-year Korean class at the University of Hawaii.
So she's Korean but was studying Korea.
She is Korean and born in Korea and went through the Korean War as a little girl. And then they moved to Japan from the time she was five or so. Then she went to Hawaii when she was 13.
Okay. Before we move into your time in the Air Force as a medical doctor, is there anything particularly memorable about your enlisted experience in Korea that you'd like to tell us?
Well, the whole experience, I guess, changed my life. My wife is Korean-American. I majored in anthropology because of the time spent overseas. I have a great appreciation for what it means to be an enlisted man. That probably cost me a higher rank eventually because of the time and grade, but I wouldn't enlist it for anything.
Okay. Now, when you finished medical school, where did you go in the Air Force?
Well, initially to Wilford Hall in San Antonio, I was selected for OBGYN training.
And was that just standard medical training, or was there anything unique about the Air Force version of that training?
Back then, it was considered categorical training. Everyone selected a residency at the very beginning rather than the old rotating internship. We wore uniforms, of course, and there were some military duties, but the average work week was probably about 110 hours a week, so there was very little time to do anything else. We operated to 11 o'clock at night and started rounds again at 5:30.
Now, was that simply because you were an intern or a resident, or was that just because of your rank?
It was peculiar to the institution. Half the operating rooms were closed for renovation, so we had to operate through the day and through the night.
After you finished your residency and your training at Wilford Hall, where did you go in the Air Force?
I went to Dyess Air Force Base in Texas. I had not completed the residency. I went into the field wondering whether I really wanted to do OBGYN or not. I was thinking of some other specialties, so the Air Force gave me the opportunity to do it for three more years. And on many occasions, because of the shortage of OBGYNs, I was left alone as the only OBGYN in the hospital once for 6 months.
Did that confirm your decision to be an OBGYN?
Yes, it did, because of course it was very different from residency training. I was doing things I probably should not have done with my level of training, but the medical corps was extremely short of people at that time, and we had to provide services to the troops.
During your time in the Air Force, did you spend any time overseas?
Well, of course, I was in Korea during my enlisted time and did go TDY for 3 months to Taiwan, which, again, increased my interest in Asia. And after that, I went 7 years later to a medical school.
Okay. But after your medical training and you're now an Air Force doctor, were you always stationed in the United States, or were you stationed sometimes in Europe or other locations?
No, I completed my residency at St. John's Mercy Medical Center in St. Louis under Air Force sponsorship, and then was sent to a base in New Mexico. At that time, my commitment was over, or would be over in a year, but I was offered Wiesbaden, Germany. So I decided to stay in the Air Force, and my family and I moved to Wiesbaden for 4 years.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about living in Wiesbaden.
Well, for anyone in anthropology like I was, or my wife who has a master's in sociology, it was fantastic. We got to travel all over. We were there at a very exciting time in the sense of terrorist activity. A lot of things were happening in Europe, and we were involved in several of the incidents that made the news. For example, the Beirut bombings, we got half the casualties from that. The Father Yenko, the TWA hostages, we had all of those at our hospital. So that part was very interesting. And then, of course, as an anthropology person, we got to travel all over Europe. I was able to go TDY to Greece and Heraklion, and we went to 13 countries, I think. During that time, I was able to go to the flight medicine training for 8 weeks at Brooks Air Force Base, and that was very impressive. I enjoyed the military part of medicine. I was able to go to the combat casualty care course, where we learned to treat battlefield injuries. They were going to use OBGYNs as surgeons, so they had a special course set up for us once at Brooks, where we did such things as intestinal surgery on animals so that we could be used in a more combat environment.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the terrorist activity in Germany. What years were you stationed in Germany?
1983 to 1987. The Beirut bombing was at that time. They stole an ID from one of the troops on our base, killed him, and then used the ID to get on Rhein-Main base and blew a bomb up in the parking lot. And we got the casualties from that.
Okay. So did you have any contact with terrorist activity other than through the casualties?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. During this time, you mentioned you were in Germany. Have you ever gone back to Wiesbaden?
So no, many of my friends have. We did take advantage of it as much as we could. We traveled all over with the children. We had two children by then, Valerie and Sam. So we did a lot of sightseeing.
You mentioned the casualties from the Marine barracks in Lebanon, which I think occurred in 83. What was that like?
Well, we were notified that something had happened, so everyone reported to the hospital, and we cleared out one floor in case we got any of the casualties. They landed at Rhein-Main Air Force Base, and then the Army got half, and we got half. We had stretchers set up in the hall, and when they brought the casualties in, they were still in their underwear. They had taken directly from the barracks. Only the top floor survived. The people on the lower floors were all killed, and many of them still had sand in their hair and sand in their eyes. But, of course, they were alive, so they weren't hurt that seriously.
How long did that episode last?
They stayed with us for a week or two, I think, and then they were transferred back to the States. The other interesting thing we had was during the Afghan invasion with Russia, we got a lot of the Afghan refugees also, but I didn't have much to do with them because they were mainly men.
So your practice was largely OBGYN and as a backup in case of an overflow or some kind of battle casualties?
It was OBGYN, but of course we're pelvic surgeons, so we went through training so that we could be utilized in a battlefield environment. We could certainly enter the abdomen, do almost anything that a surgeon could do, or a surgeon could drop by the table, complete his work, and then we could come back out of the abdomen. So during the Gulf War, that's how we were going to be utilized.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the Gulf War. What was your involvement with the Gulf War?
Almost divorce. They selected two OBGYNs to go with 1,000 troops from my hospital to RAF Nocton Hall in England to set up a contingency hospital. And they selected our chairman, who was a surgeon, gynecological surgeon, and the endocrinologist. The endocrinologist pitched the fit. And I went to the head of our department, the surgeon that was going, and said, I sure would like to go. I didn't tell my wife about this, and it got brought up in a conversation later and caused a lot of problems.
Tell me a little bit about your deployment. Mocton Hall?
Well, we went with 500 troops, medical troops from Eglin Air Force Base and some civilian doctors, and we ended up what's called a turnkey hospital, a hospital that had been maintained throughout the years, an old RAF hospital, in case the war in Europe started. This would be a place that they could bring the casualties. So it needed to be cleaned and the operating suite set up, and it would be used for an overflow from the Gulf War if we had a lot of casualties. We were anticipating that. We had some very interesting people there who were Vietnam War veterans, surgeons, and they told us of their experiences, and we trained continuously with Blue Lodge patients. We had 30 on the surgery team. We were thinking there were going to be thousands of casualties.
Were there any casualties that came to Mocton Hall?
Well, we were all set, and then it began, and they cleared the theater first. They sent out people who had been injured or wounded before the ground war started. So we received some of those who had already had the initial treatment. We closed some wounds. Battlefield wounds are often left open, so many of these were open, so we closed those. We had one guy that developed encephalitis and died, but he was the only casualty we had. We only had about 30 before it started. Interesting thing, though, is we were quartered at a British base with British troops, and we would watch television at night together of the Gulf War. And you might recall the incidents where one of our troops hit a personnel carrier of the British, killed everybody in it. And it surprised me, the British guys didn't turn around, didn't acknowledge it, didn't say anything. And then they had some bombings at Whitehall, I think, while we were there, but we didn't get any of those casualties.
Now, what happened after your deployment to Mocton Hall? You mentioned the head of your department. Were you in a teaching hospital at that time? Or?
Yes, it was a residency program. It's the second largest hospital in the Air Force, teaching hospital. And our chairman was the SGH, the second in command of the hospital, was why he went. And he was the one I went to and begged to go.
Okay. And which hospital was this?
Travis, David Grant, USAF Medical Center. Now they dropped the name and it has a number of a contingency hospital, but I don't know what it is.
Okay. And Travis Hospital, is it Travis Air Force Base in Texas?
Yes. No, California.
California. Okay. Okay. Tell us a little bit about your friendships you might have made during your career in the Air Force. Do you still keep in contact with many people from that?
Some of them have stayed friends for however many years it's been. There were 14 of us selected for Korean, and then we were together through basic training, Goodfellow Air Force Base for 3 months, starting to operate the radios and transcribe, and then 14 months in Korea. And at least two or three I still am in touch with, one almost on a daily basis where we email back and forth.
How about from your time as a doctor in the Air Force?
Not as much, actually. It's kind of strange. Physicians are very obsessed with what they're doing, and their time constraints are much different. So I haven't kept up with those people as much as I have the ones from the 60s.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the social life in the Air Force. Were there many parties and functions?
Well, during the enlisted time, it was very different. I mean, I was 22, 23 years old and single, and it was mainly a young man's environment, I guess. At Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida, where I spent my last year, we would often go just down to the beach, which has changed a great deal. During the other time, it was very much a family-oriented. We met very good friends and did a lot of traveling together in Europe. And I'm in touch with many of those friends today.
Now, I noticed that you also had a deployment to China for a brief time. That sounds interesting.
That was just a TDY during the enlisted time to Taiwan.
Okay.
No one knows how it got started, but for some reason, they sent four linguists every year for 3 months to work in a warehouse outside of Taipei at Shilinko. And I begged to go. And it was a very interesting 3 months.
Okay. Now, how long did you stay in the Air Force as a doctor?
as a physician, probably about 16 years. You know, the way they count time is very different. My total service time was 26 years, but that counts a lot of things of schools and training and inactive reserves and this type of thing.
Mm-hmm. How did you decide to leave the Air Force?
Well, it just seemed time to do that with the children. My daughter began to have emotional problems while we were in Germany, and it just seemed time to move on. But during my last several years at David Grant at Travis Air Force Base, I was the coordinator for the University of California Davis Medical Students Program that was at our hospital. So I had applied to UC Davis as a faculty member and was accepted, although I was still in uniform. So when I had the opportunity to leave the service for 20 years, I had an immediate appointment to UC Davis. So all I did was take off the uniform, and I became the director of the medical students with the OBGYN program at UC Davis and the clinic director.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your career after leaving the service.
Well, that was the main thing, is that I was with UC Davis, and I was there for 8 years.
Okay. Did you renew your interest with Asia?
Well, the anthropology was probably more important. I was the clinic director, so I was very interested in trying to provide culturally accepted medical care. So I set up clinics of just Russian-speaking patients. We had the largest Russian-speaking population in the United States using our hospital, and Spanish-speaking patients. I got very interested in this and started going to Mexico 1 to 2 weeks at a time for intensive Spanish. So I set up a clinic for Spanish speakers, and I took some medical students to Mexico to try to learn better to provide culturally sensitive, as they say, medical care.
Okay. Where do you think your interest in culturally sensitive medical care came from? Is this from the Air Force? Or?
I think everything came from the Air Force. When I joined the service, the thing I wanted to do was not go to college. I had 3 years and did not know what I wanted to do. And, of course, they sent me right back to Yale University. But the language training and the experience overseas led to my getting a bachelor's and master's in anthropology, marrying Susie, the programs I set up with the clinic, providing culturally sensitive care at UC Davis. It affected everything.
After you had left the Air Force and you're at Davis, did you still attend reunions or maintain ties with the Air Force?
They have a thing called Armed Forces District where all the services come together each year in OBGYN. So I went to those every year, presented papers and gave some talks and this type of thing. But physicians don't do that as much, I think. When it was over, it was pretty much over.
Okay. How long did you stay at UC Davis?
As a faculty member, 8 years.
Was anything particularly memorable about that?
Well, working with the patients from other cultures, I used to give talks on cultural sensitivity in medicine, and I think we recorded 17 different languages over a 3-month period in our clinic.
How did that affect your medical practice, having to deal with different cultures and languages?
Well, it was something I enjoyed a great deal, and during the senior course on culture and medicine, I gave the main talk on that, on providing culturally sensitive medical care.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you were at UC Davis for 8 years, and you're now in Fernandina Beach, what led to your decision to move from California?
Well, we visited here, and I met a friend that I had been in high school with, and he showed us around the island and actually took us to the museum, and we met the director and got very interested in it, and it just seemed like a fun thing to do. A personal problem was our daughter was having a great deal of problems psychologically now and been in and out of the hospital 3 times, but now seemed to be okay. So we felt that if we wanted to move, it was time that we could. And medical people are different. When you leave the university environment as a physician, you have left. Most of your life is pretty much over with that aspect. And we were very interested in Florida, in culture, in history, and the museum looked like a real good opportunity to explore these things.
Which museum was this?
It was the Amelia Island Museum of History.
Okay. Now, I seem to recall earlier that you thought once you left Florida and Jacksonville, you would never come back. What changed?
Bernardine was not Jacksonville, as the expression goes.
How is it different?
Well, it's a small town. I mean, it's a town of 11,000, but it has a very highly educated population with many, many things to do. It's very, very sophisticated in many ways.
And so that's very different from the Jacksonville you grew up in?
Yes.
Now, you mentioned in the Air Force that, people of various ethnic backgrounds were thrown together and there didn't seem to be many, many problems. Was that true of your early years in Jacksonville?
Well, Jacksonville was a very different town during the 50s when I was in high school. When I joined the Air Force in 1962, I had never met an African-American my age that I can recall. And then suddenly was thrown into a barracks where half was black and half was white. And I think we all discovered each other, so to speak. But I think race relations, in a way, were better in the military, certainly, during that time period than they may even be now. I don't know.
Okay. Now, you mentioned it being very good as an enlisted person. Was that also true during your time as an officer and a physician in the Air Force?
Yeah, I think it would be about the same, because the military was intolerant of any bad behavior. And most people, military is an extremely restrictive environment in which you'll never be as free. It's a paradox. You are so free in the military at the same time being confined to base. It's difficult to explain unless you've experienced it. But prejudice, you can really just drop them all because it's a safe environment.
Okay. Are there any other stories you would like to tell us about your time in the military? Any anecdotes that you would tell your children or your friends to illustrate your life in the military?
Well, it's surprising how little interested children are in anything to do with the military. The enlisted years were what determined what the rest of my life would be like. The travel overseas, some of the friends that I made to continue. The other years, of course, was my profession. And the opportunity to live in Europe. We traveled to many, many countries. It was an extremely positive experience, I think, in almost every way.
Okay. Now, you mentioned your children are not interested in the military. You think that's because of they grew up in the military?
Yeah, I think this is a common thing, that when children... Unlike the Army, the Air Force doesn't move that much. When we went somewhere, we generally spent 3 to 4 years, where the Army in our stairwell in Germany would come in for 6 months and leave with all the family, and it was not uncommon. So I think it was a good experience for them. I don't think that caused problems, for example, that my daughter had.
Are there any questions you would like me to ask you about your time in the military that I haven't asked?
I don't think so.
Are there any things you would like to add about your time in the military?
No, not really. It was a good experience, and certainly everything that I'm doing now came out of passing that Korean language test back in basic training in 1963. That started it all, and everything from scholarships to the East-West Center to medical school to the wife and children all came from the Air Force. They weren't issued, but it all came from that.
But they're not painted. Are they painted blue now?
Not at this time.
Not at this time. Okay. That concludes this interview. I'd like to thank you very much for participating. Yeah.